Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141-772-3976. That's 0141-772-3976.
This is from The National on Friday the 24th of November 2023, from the news section. Drug reform experts condemn penny mordant after SNP heroin comments. This exclusive article is written by Laura Pollock. Drugs reform campaigners have hit out at Tory minister Penny Mordaunt after she claimed that the SNP's legacy is that Scots will have somewhere safe and warm to take heroin. The leader of the House of Commons comment came as she took aim at the SNP's record, including its support for drug consumption facilities after one was approved for Glasgow. The chief executive of the Scottish Drugs Forum, Kirsten Horsburgh, said that Mordaunt's comments could cost lives, while prominent safe consumption campaigner Peter Crikant suggested the top Tory sees drug users as disposable. Crikant reacted on Twitter X, writing, "Cold-hearted comments by Penny Mordaunt. Scotland drug death rates are the highest in Europe. We are implementing something proven around the world to reduce deaths and harms, but the contempt from Ms. Mordaunt is brutal." He added, "One day people who use drugs will not be seen as disposable." Horsburgh told The National that Mordaunt's comments were undermining harm reduction approaches to drug reform and could cost lives. The Scottish Drugs Forum chief said, "This is an unhelpful perspective and derides an evidence service which engages and supports people who are particularly vulnerable to drug-related harms. The national mission of reducing drug deaths can only be delivered with a full spectrum of evidence-based effective services. Around the world, drug consumption rooms are demonstrating their value as part of a compassionate system of support, care and treatment. Undermining harm reduction approaches costs lives." SNP MP Stuart MacDonald made the same point, using his family experience to accuse Mordaunt of disgracing herself. MacDonald wrote, "You disgrace yourself, Penny Mordaunt. My brother died of a drug overdose at his home. If he had access to a healthcare facility, such as a safe consumption room, somewhere safe and warm, as you put it, in order to manage his addiction, then he might well be still alive today. The UK's first drug consumption room could be opened by next summer, with a facility planned in Glasgow already approved by NHS and council officials. The project took a step forward after Scotland's Lord Advocate Dorothy Bain, KC, announced it would not be in the public interest to prosecute users of such a facility. The UK government has said it is not in favour of drug consumption rooms, but said it has no plans to interfere. Crikant has previously accused Tory MSPs of using false information to stoke tensions around drug reform. The heated row in July started after Murdo Fraser, the Scots Conservatives' business spokesperson, suggested that anyone who backed the Scottish Government's proposals for decriminalisation of personal drug use was ignorant. At the time, Crikant said, "Some of the mistakes that the SNP have made have been brutal, but in my opinion, The new proposal makes complete sense. Decriminalisation is a logical response to what's going on in the UK right now. It isn't just in Scotland. The simple reality is that if we stop wasting money on criminalising people, we can spend it to support and help people rather than punish them. That article was written by Laura Pollock. This is from The National on Friday the 24th of November 2023, from the news section. Jeremy Hunt responds to Lee Anderson's Orkney asylum seekers plan. This article is written by Steph Braun. Jeremy Hunt has brushed off a colourful suggestion by a Tory party deputy chairman that asylum seekers could be held on Orkney if the UK government's Rwanda plan fails. Lee Anderson told GB News on Wednesday that asylum seekers should be sent to some remote Scottish island instead until their applications are processed. He claimed Orkney would be perfect for people fleeing persecution. His comments came after the Supreme Court ruled the current plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is unlawful. Asked about the remarks, Chancellor Hunt told Sky News on Thursday, "Lee will always have colourful suggestions, as he always does actually in British politics. But the fact of the matter is, we will do what it takes to stop the boats, and I think we've had that clarity from Rishi Sunak." Anderson had said, "I know it's a bit parky up there this time of year, but if people are genuinely escaping war or persecution, then a nice Scottish island with a few outbuildings would be suitable. This is a beautiful country. Parts of Scotland are a go-to destination. The remote islands. I'd like to be able to afford a place up there. If we can get some accommodation up there, keep these people safe. These people want to be safe. They're fleeing so-called persecution from these war-torn countries. If we can find an island in the Orkneys or up there that's got no one on there to start off with, put some decent accommodation on, then it's job done." The comments drew criticism from Orkney and Shetland MP Alistair Carmichael, who said the idea is not a serious proposition. The Liberal Democrats MP said, "I would be astonished if Lee Anderson could even find Orkney, or in his words, the Orkneys, on a map." His remarks show inhumanity towards desperate and vulnerable people and disdain towards island communities to boot. Anderson has form for brainstorming Tory policy live on air. Obviously, this is a novel sort of brainstorming, as it does not actually involve the engagement of a brain, but instead looks more like an exercise in corralling as many prejudices as possible into one space and calling it a policy. Carmichael added the comments are an attempt to kick up dust and distract attention from the complete failure of this government to manage our asylum and immigration system. That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday the 24th of November 2023, from the politics section. Michael Matheson under investigation in iPad expenses row. This article is written by Gregor Young. Scotland's Health Secretary is to be investigated by the Scottish Parliamentary Corporate Body, SPCB, over his near £11,000 data roaming bill racked up during a holiday to Morocco. Last week, Michael Matheson admitted in an emotional statement to MSPs his teenage sons had used his parliamentary iPad as a hotspot to watch football during a holiday in January, incurring costs of more than £7,000 in one day as a result of an out-of-date SIM card. Following a failed challenge over the bill to provider EE, Matheson initially agreed to pay £3,000 from his own expenses, and the remaining balance was paid by his office, all of which is funded by taxpayers. But following press reports about the bill, he said he would cover the full cost personally. Matheson previously told journalists there had been no personal use of the iPad during the trip, prompting accusations he had been untruthful, as he said in his statement in Holyrood that he did not initially provide the reasons for the bill when he found out earlier this month in order to protect his family. Following significant pressure from opposition politicians, Matheson referred himself to the SPCB, but was told this was not possible. In the latest twist in the saga, the body announced on Thursday it will undertake an investigation of the Health Secretary and potentially refer him to the Standards, Procedures and Public Appointments Committee. Such a referral could result in him losing access to all or part of his parliamentary expenses for such period and to such extent as the SPCB may specify, if found to have submitted an improper claim, while other unspecified action can be taken if he was found to have misused parliamentary facilities and services. Following a meeting on Thursday, the SPCB said it has a vital interest in the integrity of the members' expenses scheme as it launched a probe. Matheson said on Thursday that he will fully cooperate with the probe. Speaking to journalists after FMQs, Matheson said, "I welcome the decision by the corporate body, which follows on my writing to them last week, asking them to investigate this matter. Of course I'll fully cooperate with their investigation, and it wouldn't be appropriate for me to comment further." A spokesman for the Scottish Parliament said, "The corporate body will therefore undertake an investigation in line with its duties under the MSP Code of Conduct. The investigation will consider whether the claims for £11,000 of public money incurred through data roaming charges were proper and met the requirements of the scheme, and whether resources were used for parliamentary purposes in accordance with all SPCB policies. The SPCB will seek to conclude its investigation promptly, and its findings, in fact, will be published. Depending on those findings, there may be a number of options open to the SPCB, as set out in Section 9 of the Code of Conduct, including referral to the Standards, Procedures and Public Appointments Committee." The body said it will make no further comment until the investigation has concluded, but stressed it is wholly committed to openness and transparency and will release all material it can, when it can, in line with its legal obligations. The announcement comes after Deputy First Minister Shona Robertson said ministers aim to tell the truth to the Scottish Parliament. Pressed on whether ministers always tell Parliament and the public the truth, Robertson told BBC Radio Scotland's Good Morning Scotland programme, "I aim, and the Scottish Government aims, to do that." Michael Matheson made clear in his statement that he was trying to protect his family from being part of the associated political and media scrutiny. Asked if that means it is acceptable for ministers to lie to protect their families, Robertson insisted, "No, I didn't say that. What I am saying is Michael Matheson set out the reasons that he was trying to protect his family. He set all that out to Parliament. He has said he will cooperate with any inquiry that is established." That article was written by Gregor Young. This is from The National on Friday the 24th of November 2023, from the Culture section. Scottish restaurants named among the UK's best 100. This article is written by Andrew Smart. Several Scottish restaurants have been named among the 100 best in the UK in a new award looking at over 1.2 million diner reviews. The list, which was compiled by the popular booking app Open Table, named spots in Glasgow and Edinburgh. Beyond the volume of reviews, Open Table looked at other metrics, including diner ratings, percentage of reservations made in advance, and five-star reviews. Two eateries in Glasgow and three in Scotland's capital were named in the list, including popular cafes and fine dining experiences. Edinburgh, Café Saint-Honoré, Newtown, Forage and Chatter, Edinburgh, Skyline Restaurant, Edinburgh, and in Glasgow, Lobo and Number 16 Restaurant. Praised as undoubtedly one of the best restaurants in Edinburgh by users on TripAdvisor, Café Saint-Honoré is known for its quaint atmosphere, with users giving it a 4.5 out of 5 based on 921 reviews. Forage and Chatter has been rated a 5 out of 5 out of the 1,497 reviews, with one user writing, "The food, atmosphere and service were all top-notch. I highly recommend this excellent restaurant that serves some of the best, freshly chef-prepared meals and appetizers from local sources that defy expression in mere words." Located on Pollokshaws Road, Lobo has a 5 out of 5 on TripAdvisor and has been celebrated for its fantastic French tapas cuisine, with one visitor writing, "After hearing wonderful things from people on Instagram, my friends and I decided to give this lovely place a try. It was a fantastic experience. The atmosphere was nice and relaxed. The staff were very friendly and helpful. The food was amazing." Number 16 in Glasgow's West End was another spot to make it on the list, with the restaurant boasting a Michelin star. That article was written by Andrew Smart. This is from The National on Friday the 24th of November 2023. From the comments section. Why this UK autumn statement is a disaster for Scotland. This article is written by Professor Richard Murphy. Jeremy Hunt's UK autumn statement, delivered in Westminster yesterday, was a disaster. We already know that the amount of the new money he allocated to Scotland is way less than is needed. We also know that Hunt's national insurance changes can only make management of the Scottish tax system more difficult, as if he has no interest in supporting devolved taxation. Difficult as these things are, though, they are not the real reason why this autumn statement was so terrible for Scotland. That real reason is a consequence of four things. The first of these is that despite the national insurance giveaway yesterday, the overall rate of tax paid by most people in Scotland will increase as a result of this autumn statement. That need not be the case. Hunt could have chosen to cut taxes for most people whilst increasing taxes on those with wealth. That way he could have provided a real stimulus to the economy, whilst cutting inequality that would, though, have gone against every Tory principle, so he was not going to do that. Second, austerity is returning. The only way that Hunt could justify the tax and national insurance giveaway that he made yesterday was by delivering lower levels of borrowing in the future. He is reducing borrowing by planning to spend less on public services. It is true that some core activities like health and education are supposedly exempted from such cuts, but the consequences of that is that the austerity to come in other services might be at least as bad as it was under David Cameron and George Osborne from 2010 until 2015. If you think services are bad now, things are going to get very much worse. Third, as my calculations have shown, there is also a plan to cut government investment in the economy by 16.7% over the next 5 years. Although we glaringly obviously need more investment in social housing, flood protection, the green transition, the rebuilding of schools and hospitals that are impacted by failing materials, and so much more, less money is going to be made available for these purposes. That is quite staggering. Fourth, There was the reaction of the Labour spokespeople to this autumn statement. It was obvious to every single commentator who spent much time reading the budget documentation that this autumn statement is a plan for economic failure. Its sole real purpose is to booby-trap Labour when it comes into office. It does this by challenging them to adopt it, terrible as it is. And yet, none of these Labour spokespeople would acknowledge that or address the issues arising. They are all so terrified of making a spending commitment of any sort that they would rather say nothing instead of talking about what really needs to be done. In that case, it seems all too apparent that Labour shares the Tory aspiration to fail. I strongly suspect that they will succeed in doing so. All of this created an unusual problem for me. I rarely have a problem with going to sleep. I know that is good fortune. I sympathise with everyone challenged by insomnia. Last night I got a little insight into what it is like to toss and turn, and to fret and worry whilst despairing about the options available, none of which appear to be good, because that is what I did until too long into the night. We have a UK economy that is failing. Very largely it is doing so because of the actions chosen by politicians, or their beloved appointees at the Bank of England. It is politicians who say that we cannot tax wealth more. It is politicians have chosen to impose taxes on those least able to pay them. It is politicians who have said as a result that we cannot afford to spend on essential public services. And it is politicians who refuse to understand that the so-called national debt is nothing more than private savings deposited with the government, because people wish for the security that government savings accounts can alone provide. It is because of the incompetence of these politicians, most of whom were taught on one particular degree course at the University of Oxford, that we, as a country, face catastrophe. Their dogmatic refusal to imagine alternative economic models to the market-based absurdity of neoliberalism that they were taught in the youth is what is condemning us to this mess. This morning I have an overwhelming feeling that Scotland needs another plan. To be candid, I think the UK as a whole shares that need. The trouble is, no one has got close to writing it. What I have somewhat reluctantly asked myself as a result is whether or not I can now afford having a go at writing that plan. After all, how much worse do things have to get before I am left with no choice but to give it a go? That article was written by Professor Richard Murphy.
This is from The National on Monday, 27th November 2023. From the News section. Booker Prize 2023. Irish author Paul Lynch wins with Prophet Song. By Laura Pollock. Irish author Paul Lynch said he thought he was dooming his career by writing Prophet Song before winning the 2023 Booker Prize. The 46-year-old, who lives in Dublin, was presented with his trophy by last year's winner Sheehan Karutnalaka at the ceremony held at Old Billingsgate, London. Lynch told Sunday's event, "Well, there goes my hard-won anonymity. That was not an easy book to write. The rational part of me believed I was dooming my career by writing this novel, though I had to write the book anyway. We do not have a choice in such matters." Lynch also thanked all the children of this world who need our protection, yet have lived and continue to live through the terrors depicted in this book. He added, "Thank you for opening our eyes to innocence, so that we may know the world again as though for the first time. It is with immense pleasure that I bring the Booker home to Ireland." He is the fifth Irish author to win the award, worth £50,000, according to the Booker Prize, following Dame Iris Murdoch, John Banville, Roddy Doyle and Anne Enright. The event on Sunday had a keynote speech delivered by Nazan Zaghari Ratcliffe, who was released from prison in Iran last year. Lynch's fifth novel, Prophet's Song, which is a tale of tyrannical government, is about a mother of four working as a scientist whose husband is taken away by the newly formed Irish secret police. Canadian novelist Essay Edugan, chairwoman of the 2023 judges and a previous Booker shortlisted author, called the tale a triumph of emotional storytelling, bracing and brave. With great vividness, Prophet's Song captures the social and political anxieties of our current moment, she said. Readers will find it soul-shattering and true, but will not forget its warnings. She was asked during a press call if the judges had considered recent events in Dublin, where, after a knife attack on children, there followed a series of violent disturbances. Edugan said it was mentioned at some point when the book was chosen on Saturday. I really have to stress that was not the reason that Prophet's Song won the prize, and that we weren't sort of taking our cue from world events in such a direct fashion. I think it would have done a great disservice to the prize, she added. Edugan also said that the judges felt it would have been a massive impact and that it would outlast this age. The violence in the Irish capital, which involved far-right elements, on Thursday saw Garda cars, buses and trams set alight, shops looted and damaged. The judges also included peep show actor Robert Webb, Rodgerton actress Adjoa Ando, poet and critic Mary John Shan, and James Shapiro, a professor of English and comparative literature in Columbia University. During the ceremony, Ando also read an extract from the 1990 Booker Prize winning novel Possession, in honour of British author A.S. Byatt, who died earlier this month at the age of 87. Gabby Wood, chief executive of the Booker Prize Foundation, said the judges established at the start of the final meeting that any of the six books on the shortlist would be a worthy winner. Prophet's Song is composed of masterful sentences and packs a profound emotional punch. Lynch told the PA news agency in September that the book did not have to be a warning about authoritarianism, as it's actually already occurring. He said, "What informs this book is the sense of liberal democratic slide that's been ongoing around the world for the past 6, 8 years, perhaps 10 years. It was the sense of unravelling that so many of us have just been tuning into and feeling anxious about the thought that this could happen here. No, it couldn't, but yet there are so many countries around the world where they thought the very same thing." Lynch also beat fellow Irish writer Paul Murray, who was shortlisted for The Bee Sting, which follows an Irish family facing financial and emotional troubles. All the shortlisted authors, which also include British author Chetna Maru, American novelist Jonathan Escoffrey, Canadian author Sarah Bernstein, and US author Paul Harding, received £2,500 and a bespoke bound edition of their book. Margaret Atwood, Dame Hilary Mantel, and Sir Salman Rushdie are among previous Booker winners. That article was by Laura Pollock. This is from The National on Monday, 27th November, 2023. From the News section. Officer hospitalised as riot police deployed to Scottish village. By Xander Elliards. The police have reported large-scale disorder in the Ayrshire village of Auchinleck on Saturday, with one police officer hospitalised. Video posted to social media showed fireworks being thrown at officers as riot police tried to deal with the ongoing incident. Officers are reviewing such video footage to trace those responsible for the disorder. Detective Inspector Louise White of Ayrshire Division said, "An investigation is underway following an incident of large-scale disorder in Auchinleck on Saturday, November 25th. Officers were called to reports of a crowd gathered on Old Avenue. The crowd moved to other addresses in the area and public order officers attended to assist when the crowd refused to disperse when requested. Unfortunately, during the incident, some of those gathered became extremely hostile towards the police, and one officer was struck by a firework and taken to hospital for treatment. Police officers have a duty to ensure the safety of everyone involved in such incidents, but this kind of behaviour is completely unacceptable. Although the crowd later dispersed, our investigation is ongoing to trace those responsible and ensure they are dealt with appropriately. This will include reviewing any available video footage." That article was by Xander Elliards. This is from The National on Monday, 27th November 2023, from the Politics section. Scottish Minister writes to DWP over concerning benefits rules change. By Adam Robertson. Scotland's Social Justice Secretary has written a letter to the UK government raising deeply concerning changes on how people are assessed as being able to work. Changes to work capability assessments were announced by Chancellor Jeremy Hunt earlier this week. New rules will mean that people could receive less support based on a change of criteria as opposed to a change in their health, Shirley Ann Somerville has suggested. Writing to the Department for Work and Pensions, or DWP, Secretary Mel Stride, she highlighted how the Scottish Government has taken a different approach with its social security system. She said, "I remain deeply concerned about the changes to the activities and descriptors for getting about, for limited capability for work, and the mobilising and substantial risk criteria for limited capability for work-related activity. The changes you are proposing, including the extension of the sanctions regime, will have very significant additional impact on some of the most vulnerable people in our communities who need our support most." The letter continued, "In Scotland, we have taken a different approach to devolved employability support. Our services remain voluntary, and we want the support we provide to be seen as an opportunity, not a threat, with fairness, dignity and respect at its heart. In delivering our first devolved employability service, Fair Start Scotland, Scottish Government officials had a close working relationship with Job Centre Plus to ensure we were collectively working to provide support for the people of Scotland." Addressing the Commons on Wednesday, Hunt pledged to increase universal credit by 6.7%, in line with September's inflation figures. However, as expected, he set out a tougher stance on benefits as he looked to move more people into work. "If, after 18 months of intensive support, job seekers have not found a job, we will roll out a programme requiring them to take part in a mandatory work placement to increase their skills and improve their employability," he said. "And if they choose not to engage with the job work search process for 6 months, we will close their case and stop their benefits." A DWP spokesperson said, We are determined to provide a welfare system that supports people into work while providing a vital safety net for those who need it most. That is why we are changing the work capability assessment, shifting the focus to what people can do rather than what they can't, while keeping protections in place for those with the most significant health conditions. We are also offering existing health claimants a chance to work guarantee, allowing people to try work without fear of losing their benefits, alongside our Back to Work plan, which will support up to 1.1 million people with long-term health conditions, disabilities, or long-term unemployment to look for and stay in work. That article was by Adam Robertson.
From the National, Monday the 27th of November, from the comment section, why it's so important that Scotland divests from the arms trade? Article by Rhys Crelly. Since October the 7th, social media screens have been filled with images of gruesome violence from Israel-Palestine. Israelis killed or kidnapped in the desert. Palestinian children with limbs amputated on hospital floors. Buildings that were once home to families in Gaza, now broken piles of rubble, with the inhabitants buried underneath. Photographs and videos of endless horrors accompanying an ever-increasing death toll of names. Israel's war in Gaza is hard to watch. Many of us will no doubt have already turned away, scrolling quickly past images of conflict as the pain of others becomes too much to bear. In the face of such destruction, it's easy to feel helpless. What we can do to alleviate or stop the suffering in Gaza, 2,500 miles away from the comfort of our homes in Scotland? Many of us have called for a ceasefire and taken to the streets in the biggest anti-war protests since the Iraq War. These displays of solidarity are important. They demonstrate that many people in Scotland are opposed to Israel's brutal bombardment of Gaza. However, now that the four-day ceasefire is coming to an end, we need to take further action to prevent more horror in Gaza. We need Scotland to divest from the arms trade. The UK has licensed £442 million worth of arms to Israel since 2015, and these arms are produced across the UK, including Scotland. For instance, the F-35 fighter jet used by Israeli Air Force to drop bombs in Gaza is manufactured jointly by Lockheed Martin and BAE Systems, both of whom operate from sites across Scotland. The laser targeting system for the F-35 is made in Edinburgh. Other arms companies whose weapons and equipment have been used by Israel and Gaza are based in Glasgow and Fife. These private companies are subsidised by the UK and Scottish governments. In 2021, an investigation by the Ferret reported that the Scottish enterprise had given £10 million in grants to arms companies. While these multinational corporations are subsidised by us taxpayers, the profits are kept in private hands. Research published earlier this year by the think tank Commonwealth found that since 2010, UK-based arms companies have paid their shareholders a total of £368.8 billion. As Professor Anna Stavrinakis, an arms trade expert at the University of Sussex, has recently pointed out, this is a form of corporate welfare, where arms companies profit and British taxpayers and innocent civilians in Gaza pay the price. Arms companies are also funded by investments held by Scottish universities. According to the Glasgow University Arms Divestment Coalition, the University of Glasgow has invested more than £6.8 million in arms companies, including those that provide weapons to Israel. Last week, the lethal implications of these investments were made clear as University of Glasgow alumni Demia Alhaj died alongside her 6-month son Abud, husband Mohammed, and 2 brothers after their home was bombed in the south of Gaza. Dima worked for the World Health Organization and, according to colleagues, there she was, a wonderful person with a radiant smile. Days before her death, Dima messaged the Scottish family who hosted her during her studies here, expressing hope that her son lives to see better days. Instead, his life was cut tragically short. As the alumni of our great learning institutions are killed alongside their children, by the kind of weapons designed, produced and sold by companies in Scotland, we need to divest from the arms trade. The Scottish Government should immediately call for the UK Government to suspend all arms exports to Israel and investigate how arms designed or produced by companies based in Britain have contributed to civilian casualties in Gaza. At the same time, Scottish Enterprise should suspend the award of all grants to arms companies which export to Israel, and all Scottish universities should divest from these same companies. Scottish workers at these companies should down tools, and the Scottish Government should support a just transition away from the arms industry. The award-winning 2018 documentary, Nay Pakistan, about the Scottish Rolls-Royce workers who refused to service and repair engines for General Pinochet's Chilean Air Force fighter jets in the 1970s, shows that Scottish workers can take a stand for justice and help prevent atrocities overseas. The lesson here is that Scotland should do what is right, and our government, our universities and workers should say farewell to arms. And that article was by Rhys Kelly, who's a lecturer in international relations at the University of Glasgow.
The National, recorded on Monday, 27th of November, 2023. Culture, marking the centenary of Red Clydeside hero John McLean's death. By Hamish McPherson, journalist. Thursday is St Andrew's Day, and the feast of our patron saint will be celebrated by Scots everywhere. More than a few Scottish people will also mark the centenary of the death of a hugely influential man who never held elected office, but was seen as a great leader of the working class. The death of John McLean on November 30, 1923, must have made the British ruling class think they'd finally been rid of a thorn in their side, a menace to capitalism and a campaigner for a Scottish republic. How little they knew, for since his death, McLean's fame has continually grown, and even 100 years on, his legacy inspires the left not just in Scotland but abroad. He passed away at the age of just 44, and I personally consider him to have suffered martyrdom for his causes, given the treatment he received from the British state. Warning, I will be mentioning the specifics of that treatment. The facts of McLean's life are well known. He was born on August 24, 1879, to a Gaelic-speaking couple in Pollokshaws, the second youngest of seven children of Daniel McLean and his wife Anne. McLean was raised in a Calvinist household and trained as a teacher for the Free Church of Scotland. He attended Glasgow University on a part-time basis, graduating MA in 1904. At university, he met the future leading figure of Red Clydeside, Jimmy Maxton, and they became friends. McLean studied the political economics of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels, and taught socialist theory in night classes in Glasgow before the First World War. He joined the Social Democratic Foundation, SDF, forerunner of the British Socialist Party, which he jointly founded. He founded the Pollokshaws branch of the SDF, assisted by James McDougall, then just 16, who would become McLean's chief supporter and assistant. Working as a teacher, McLean met and married his wife Agnes, and they would have two children, his daughter, the late Nan Milton, writing her father's biography and doing much to preserve his memory. A brilliant and compelling orator, in the years before the First World War, he began to promote communism, republicanism and independence for Scotland, and by August 1914, he'd been warning for many months that a war of empires was on the way, using information that he had gathered from his many international links with fellow socialists. He was one of the first people in the UK to condemn the war, and urged the working classes not to get involved, and was thus one of the early targets of the British state. In Glasgow he spoke before thousands during the rent strike of 1915, and composed letters to the Westminster government, which helped bring about the law that froze rents. His opposition to conscription won him many supporters in Clydeside and elsewhere, but cost him his job as a teacher. He was sacked the day before his arrest on October 27, 1915, on charges under the Defence of the Realm Act. He became a full-time lecturer on Marx and socialism, but his card had been marked. After a farce of a trial in 1916, he was sentenced to 3 years of penal servitude. The Russian Revolution and a public campaign for his release the following year saw McLean freed early, but it was clear to his family and friends that he'd suffered greatly in prison. After the revolution in Russia, Lenin appointed McLean the Soviet's honorary consul in Great Britain, but the British government refused to accept his appointment. He continued to speak against the war, and in May 1918, he was put in trial for sedition. His speech from the dock is generally reckoned to be one of the greatest speeches in Scottish history. I consider capitalism the most infamous, bloody and evil system that mankind has ever witnessed. My language is regarded as extravagant language, but the events of the past 4 years have proved my contention. No government is going to take from me my right to speak, my right to protest against wrong, my right to do everything that is for the benefit of mankind. I am not here then as the accused. I am here as the accuser of capitalism, dripping with blood from head to foot. This time he was sentenced to 5 years penal servitude, and in Peterhead prison he went on hunger strike and was force-fed in government instructions with a tube put down his throat to fill his stomach. We know from his own words what conditions were like in prison. The cell in Peterhead is about 4 feet broad, 8 feet long, and less than 7 feet high. Just a little box. The cell window is very small and broad spars outside prevent much light entering the cell. The glass is so twisted that the prisoner cannot see out. The purpose is to make him brood and fret. Imagine if you can how dreary a Sunday must be to a man who cannot read or to whom reading is a difficulty and not a pleasure. And many convicts are illiterate. The only relief on a Sunday is 20 minutes exercise, service at the chapel and Sunday school for Protestants if they care to attend. Most cells are very cold in winter as the method of heating is of no use, and to wrap oneself around with blankets is a crime the governor can punish by sending a man to the separate cells, each more miserable than the others. The campaign to free him was again successful. Thousands gathered to greet him on his return to Glasgow. His health had been utterly broken in Peterhead, however. His wife Agnes wrote that he had been going through torture and slow murder. He was out speaking in November, but after an incident in which he gave his overcoat to a West Indian, McLean contracted pneumonia and died at his home in Althouse Road in Pollockshaws just days later. At his funeral, many thousands lined the streets of Glasgow to pay tribute to the hero of the working classes. A century later, he is still revered. By Hamish McPherson, The National, recorded on Monday, 27th of November, 2023. Culture. The Scarlet Alchemist, A Magical Tale of Alchemy and Intrigue, by Gemma E. McLaughlin. The Scarlet Alchemist, by Kylie Lee Baker, published by Hodder & Stoughton. This brand new novel from the author of another dark young adult fantasy, The Keeper of Night, is the first in a two-book series which will make the second instalment near impossible to wait for. While many have long dismissed ideas of something similar to magic existing, this was not yet the case many years ago in Tang Dynasty China. People once worked tirelessly in attempts to harness the elements of the natural world through alchemy in order to disrupt the natural order and bring about immortality. The Scarlet Alchemist is a bold twist in this history and viscerally immerses the reader in a version of events in which this worked. What would life have been like had the power to extend it been found? How might this be distributed, and where would the true powers lie? In answering these questions, Baker refuses to create any kind of utopia, drawing skillfully and authentically instead on the issues of race, gender and class divisions we will all recognise. Xylan's only option is perfection. Her Celtic alchemist father arrived in China to study their developments, but after falling in love with her mother, he later disappears on the day of her death. With alchemy and mystery in her blood, Xylan struggles with what family means as a biracial orphan, relying on cousins Wenshu and Yufei, like siblings. While by day the three of them work together in her aunt and uncle's shop, by night Xylan resurrects the dead for ever-increasing prices to keep their struggling home afloat. Though they keep this secret, they long for escape and a more legitimate and stable income. But the only way to achieve this is the taxing and even dangerous exams commoners may take to prove themselves worthy of work in the capital. Xylan knows she is a talented enough alchemist to fight and scratch her way through the tough and brutal competition, but will she want it when she gets there? With every odd stacked against her, whether from her roots in poverty, her mixed heritage, or being underestimated due to her gender, she makes an underdog any reader would hope for. Caught up in political games, Xylan is exposed to the gritty truth of the glittering capital of beautiful people, extending their lives as long as they can, with no care for those starving. It is these very people for whom she must use her extraordinary talents in alchemy, allowed finally to practice the extent of her powers and test boundaries. The sumptuously dark and vicious twists of this story, bound by the magic of life, blood and familial love, will have any young fantasy fan hooked in an instant. Kylie Lee Baker is a master of the world-building skills that can make historical fiction feel like stepping into a nightmare and a dream at once, with an unforgettably stubborn protagonist you'll want to follow until the end. By Gemma E. McLaughlin.
From the National, on Tuesday the 28th of November 2023, from the Politics section. Scottish Child Payment Benefit reaching more than 300,000 children. This article was written by Judith Duffy. The families of more than 300,000 under-16s are benefiting from the Scottish Child Payment, new figures show, as charities have called for the payment to be increased. The payment of £25 was reaching 323,315 children at the end of September, an increase of more than 7,000 compared to June this year, according to Scottish Government statistics. Scotland's Social Justice Secretary said the payment was in stark contrast to the UK Government's approach of continued austerity. However, more than 150 charities, faith groups, trade unions and community organisations from across Scotland have signed an open letter asking First Minister Humza Yousaf to make good on his leadership campaign commitment to raise the Scottish payment from £25 to £30 a week as a first step to meet child poverty targets. The Scottish Government has previously twice increased Scottish child payment, first from £10 to £20 per week per child, then to £25 when it extended to include all eligible children under 16 in November last year. But the letter highlights the payment has not been increased for 16 months despite hard-pressed families facing inflation rates that have not been experienced for decades, with low-income households being the worst affected. Signatories to the letter include the Archbishop of Glasgow, the Children's Commissioner, the General Secretary of the Scottish Trade Unions Congress, STUC, and the head of dozens of children's charities and anti-poverty groups. They say tens of thousands of children across Scotland are currently locked in poverty, and the looming budget is a critical test of the Scottish Government's willingness to match its stated ambition of shifting on the dial on the problem. John Dickey, director of the Child Poverty Action Group, CPAG, in Scotland, said, Today's letter to the First Minister demonstrates the largest yet coalition of support for a further increase to the Scottish child payment and a prioritising of child poverty across government spending. The First Minister himself has said his defining mission is to shift the dial on child poverty and that he wants to see the child payment increased to £30 in his first budget. It's now critical for Scotland's children that his tax and spending plans deliver on those commitments. Ros Foyer, General Secretary of the STUC, said child poverty is an absolute scandal that should shame those in positions of power. The STUC is proud to support the call for significant additional investment to tackle child poverty in the upcoming budget. During the cost of living crisis, raising the Scottish child payment from £25 to £30 per week is imperative to ensure that families have enough to live on. We need to see significant investment to improve the lives of millions, to loosen the grip of poverty. The statistics from the Scottish Government also show that the combined overall amount paid out across Social Security Scotland's five family payments since they launched is more than £596 million. The majority, £458.5 million, is the Scottish child payment, with £138.1 million for the rest of the five family payments, Best Start Foods and three Best Start grants combined. Social Justice Secretary Shirley Ann Somerville said, as the First Minister has made clear, tackling child poverty is a key mission for the Scottish Government, and these figures show we are reaching more of the children and young people who need our help. We're doing it quickly too. It is estimated that Scottish child payment will lift around 50,000 children out of poverty in the current financial year. Our work with this uniquely Scottish benefit is in stark contrast with the UK government's approach of continued austerity, further outlined in the Chancellor's autumn statement last week. Scottish Child Payment, Best Start Foods, and our Best Start grants provide a robust safety net and are among many actions we are taking in government to lift people out of poverty. However, I would continue to encourage people to spread the word, as we want all eligible to get the help they are entitled to. The draft Scottish Budget for 2024 to 2025 will be published on December 19th. That article was written by Judith Duffy. From the National, on Tuesday the 28th of November 2023, from the Politics section. What the media isn't telling you about the Israeli-Hamas war. This article was written by Mandy Turner. Why do Israelis get killed, but Palestinians die? Why do Israelis have children, but Palestinians have people aged 18 and younger? It's subtle, but the choice of words is important because they show up a serious imbalance in how the suffering of Palestinians is portrayed compared to that of Israelis. Outright censorship is easier to spot and call out. Last week, the BBC edited out multiple calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, which were made during speeches by filmmakers and actors at the Scottish BAFTA Awards. But too many people have watched the live coverage and spotted the huge difference in the version the BBC made available afterwards on its streaming service, iPlayer. When challenged, the BBC said it was complying with its editorial guidelines on impartiality, but that surely impartiality would mean omitting some of the speeches, not all of them. The BBC has a long history of editing out references to Palestine. In February 2011, it covered up the word Palestine in a freestyle performance on Radio 1 Extra by rapper Mick Righteous, with the sound of breaking glass. The lyrics were contentious, the BBC argued, because they implied that Palestine is not free, and this is why we made the edit. But international law and world opinion regards Palestine to be occupied by Israel, which surely counts as not being free. A few years earlier, the BBC provoked widespread outrage when it refused to air a Disasters Emergency Committee humanitarian charity fundraising appeal for Gaza after Israel's bombing campaign in 2008 to 2009. This was the first and only time the BBC has done this. These are all very visible and clumsy examples of censorship. But given they are being implemented by the UK's leading news source, it should be ringing alarm bells. With its move anti-beep, it's deliberately airbrushing out of history the voices of leading British public figures, actors, filmmakers, musicians, and humanitarians. We should be able to hear these opinions and judge them for ourselves, because they provide a critical counterpoint to the UK government, which has clearly taken sides and is sending warships and spy planes to assist Israel. There have been some accusations of pro-Palestine bias in the media, particularly towards the BBC, but not on the same scale. Besides a few rare exceptions, the media mostly falls in line with its government stance. Since October 7th, there have been a wave of suppression and censorship of Palestinian voices and of those expressing solidarity with Palestinians in Western media. Censorship. I experienced this myself from the UK's leading international affairs think tank, Clapham House, noting this increase in censorship. The Guardian commissioned US lawyer Dylan Saba to write a piece on it. Then, without a hint of irony, the paper dropped the article, blaming the decision on someone higher up. Simultaneously, the newspaper recently dismissed satirical cartoonist Steve Bell over his depiction of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Bell had been given The Guardian for more than 40 years. Bell had been with The Guardian for more than 40 years, sorry. This type of outright censorship is very visible. What is more difficult to point and criticise this selective framing of events. Israelis' military violence against Palestinians is always reported as a response to Palestinian attacks. This framing has been used in 2022, 2021, 2020, 2019, and 2018. I could go on, using every year going back decades and referencing different Western media outlets, but the headlines and message remain the same. Palestinians carry out terror attacks. Israel is defending itself. Providing international context is difficult in the fast-moving media environment, but it needs to be done. Otherwise, how can people understand what is going on? Double standards. The BBC has been accused by 8 of its UK-based journalists of not portraying the situation accurately and for using terms such as massacre and atrocity only when referring to the Hamas attack on Israelis on October 7th and not about the attack of Israel on Palestinians in Gaza. In a letter to the broadcaster Al Jazeera, the journalist who wrote anonymously fearing reprisal further charged that the national broadcaster was humanising Israelis by using their names, covering funerals and interviewing family members, but failing to do the same for Palestinians. Such double standards led to its journalists crying in toilets. The tabloid press is even worse. The Sun ignored the UK's responsibility for creating the conditions for the conflict, omitting the mention that the 1974 Balfour Declaration and the British colonial bias against Palestinian Arabs. This is what led to the Jewish state in the Holy Land and the depossession of Palestinian Arabs. I haven't even dared to read the Daily Mail. How the media reports on the situation in Israel and Palestine matters because it helps to shape public opinion. History did not begin on October 7th. Israel has been occupying, colonising and building an apartheid regime over Palestine for 75 years. If we do not understand this basic fact, history will keep repeating itself and more people, particularly Palestinians, will be killed. Mandy Turner is a Professor of Conflict, Peace and Humanitarian Affairs at the University of Manchester. That article was by Mandy Turner.
The National News on Wednesday, the 29th of November. Homeless Project Scotland secures an indoor venue for the winter. An article written by Marissa McWhirter. A charity soup kitchen has secured an indoor premises ahead of the coldest winter months after years of campaigning. Homeless Project Scotland will have a safe and warm building in the Merchant City area of Glasgow to continue their life-saving work for 3 months as the bitter cold sets in. The charity was forced to move from Argyle Street to Broomielaw Street for almost 3 months after claims of bullying and intimidation from traders who had sent a petition to Network Rail and the council to force the charity to move. Following the controversy, Glasgow businessman Barry Cushley offered the charity a new home for 3 months in the basement of a building his company owns on Glasford Street. They hope to have the new centre up and running by the end of next week. After it was revealed that 244 homeless people died on Scotland streets last year, charity boss Colin McInnes hailed the new space as life-saving. Homeless Project Scotland has been working towards securing an indoor safe sanctuary for those struggling in the city since the organisation was founded in 2019. Mr. McInnes said, "We are over the moon. This is what we have been working towards since the very start, creating a safe space for the people who need it most. This is 100% going to save lives. It will massively reduce the number of deaths on the streets this winter in Glasgow. A safe, warm place for us to work, to feed and look after people is all we've wanted, and now we have it. We want to create a 24-hour welfare centre to provide shelter, warmth and hot food to homeless and vulnerable people. It's the first of its kind in the UK, and we plan to run this for 3 months to preserve life in the depths of winter. We have this building for the next 3 months initially, so the coldest, most dangerous time of the year. It means the world to us. Mr. Cushley has done something no one else in the city has been willing to do. He's turned over an area of a building to us to do whatever we need to do to help people. An agreement is currently being drawn up, and volunteers will be able to move in and adapt the space once the keys are handed over. Mr. Cushley, who runs investment firm CNC Group, reached out to Mr. McInnes to set up the agreement. Mr. McInnes said, "It's an incredible thing and it means so much. We just want to help people and we can now help so many more." The basement of a premium building in Mr. Cushley's portfolio will be signed over for exclusive use by Homeless Project Scotland for 3 months, but the executive says he hopes to help out even more. Mr. Cushley said, "It broke my heart to see what the team at Homeless Project Scotland is going through with moving to an area they felt unsafe and now going back to where they'd been chased from. I felt I had to do something. I'm fortunate to be in a position where I can do something to help Mr. McInnes and his team right now, to get their people and the families they help off the streets for the coldest months of the year. We've been able to give them full use of a private, warm, dry, safe and secure area of a building we own. We've agreed it's initially for the next 3 months. Mr. McInnes will have the keys and it's theirs to operate and manage as they need it." He added, "I've made mistakes in my life when I was a young idiot, but I'm a different guy now and just want to help bring about good things for people who need it. I got a second chance and want to give that to others. It's vital. Everyone deserves a second chance. I really want to give something back to the city, and this feels like an important thing. I had to do this. I couldn't stand by and see stories of people not being safe when they're doing such amazing work. This is just the beginning for Homeless Project Scotland and my team. There are a lot of ideas already about other ways we can maybe help out in the near future, and way beyond that too. This is just the start, I promise. And if anyone else can help, please do. I've tried to support individuals before, but it rarely works, sadly. If you want to really help, work with the people who know how to use that help, like Homeless Project Scotland." An article written by Marissa McWhirta. The National News on Wednesday, the 29th of November. New poll shows a record support for abolishing the monarchy. An article written by Hamish Morrison. More than a third of people want to replace King Charles with an elected head of state, according to a new poll. People's preference for the monarchy stands at 52% versus 34% of people who want to ditch the institution, research by Savanta has found. Campaign group Republic said support for getting rid of the monarchy was now at record levels. Polling by another firm, Ipsos, in May found support for Britain becoming a republic was at the then record high of 28%. Graham Smith, the group's chief executive, said, "This is a watershed moment for the anti-monarchy movement, with one in three now wanting to elect their head of state. Polling since the start of the year has consistently shown a big drop in support for the monarchy over the past decade. 2023 was supposed to be the year the royals secured their future." He branded the coronation a PR extravaganza to manage the transition from Queen Elizabeth to King Charles after the late Queen's death and her son's ascent to the throne. Mr. Smith added, "The royals were able to rely on more friendly media coverage than they could ever hope for, and a cavalcade of important people lining up to talk up its greatness, history, importance and necessity. Yet all that effort and expense has failed to shift the dial in their favour. Instead, the year ends with a record number wanting to elect the UK's head of state. With one in three people now preferring a republic, this issue has to be addressed seriously by politicians and by the media. We're not a nation of royalists, and in time we will become a nation that overwhelmingly wants the monarchy gone." An article written by Hamish Morrison. The National on Wednesday, the 29th of November. Opinion. Michael Shanks shows the worth of obedience in the Labour Party. A column written by The Wee Ginger Doug. In proof that slavish obedience does wonders for your career, Labour's new boy Michael Shanks has been promoted to Sir Keir Starmer's front bench after a political career which has so far lasted less time than it takes BBC Scotland to publicise the latest SNP bad story. Less than 2 weeks after making his maiden speech, and a mere 54 days after being elected, Mr Shanks is now a shadow Scotland Office Minister. Mr Shanks admitted that he didn't vote Labour in 2019, but now here he is on the Labour front benches in the Commons. It's a fair guess that he won't be voting against the two-child cap on benefits after all then. It's also safe to assume that Michael Shanks will adopt whatever political position which happens to be most advantageous to his career at any given time. Few have climbed the greasy pole of Labour politics with such single-minded determination. In 6 weeks, Mr Shanks went from claiming to oppose half of Sir Keir Starmer's policies to serving on his front bench. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you a future Labour member of the House of Lords. The untoward speed of Mr Shanks' promotion is highly unlikely to mean that he is possessed of godlike talents, which he kept carefully hidden during the by-election campaign. Far more plausibly, it means that Mr Starmer recognises Mr Shanks is obedient lobby fodder, who will do as he's told and who will loyally back the Starmer line in Labour's Scottish branch office. The people of Rutherglen and Hamilton West have an MP who, despite his promises, does not represent them, and he will not stand up for their interests. He represents the leadership of the Labour Party and himself, and the interests he stands up for are those that Keir Starmer tells him to. He might be a new MP, but it's an age-old Labour story. Those years in the Scottish political wilderness have taught the Labour Party nothing at all. Starmer's Labour keeps telling us that they are the change Scotland needs, but Labour itself has not changed. Its brief dalliance with social democracy under Mr Corbyn is being airbrushed from history, and it's back to centre-right neoliberalism under the centralising and dictatorial Starmer. Labour may well enjoy an electoral boost in Scotland at the next Westminster general election, but its success will be short-lived. As a party which has Douglas Alexander, a former minister under Blair and Brown, and Blair MacDougall, the head of the Better Together campaign in 2014, as candidates, it will very rapidly reveal itself to be unchanged from the Labour Party that Scotland so resoundingly rejected in 2015. This is a Labour Party which is desperate to lock Scotland back in its box. They seek a Scotland which is politically neutralised and which will not resist as the big boys and girls at Westminster make all the important decisions. Then they will turn their sights on further undermining the Scottish Parliament in the supposed aim of empowering local authorities, where Labour has a better chance of being in control. Don't say you haven't been warned, but hey, at least BBC Scotland will be happy. New figures have revealed that 244 people died while homeless in Scotland in 2022. There is an epidemic of homelessness across the UK, a product of the failure of successive governments to invest in growing the stock of social housing and of conservative austerity policies and repeated assaults on benefits claimants, which have reduced thousands to destitution and left them unable to afford basic necessities, such as keeping a roof over their heads. Although Scotland has invested more than other parts of the UK in the delivery of affordable housing, it's not immune to the Conservatives' erosion of the benefit system or their squeeze on the funding which is made available to the Scottish Government via the Barnett formula, which ultimately makes Scotland's finances dependent on spending decisions which the Conservative at Westminster make for England. Homelessness is on the rise across the UK. According to official UK government figures, in England, an estimated 3,069 people spent the night sleeping rough in 2022, an annual increase of 26%, the biggest year-on-year rise since 2015, and 74% higher than 2010, the year these statistics were first collected. Estimates of the number of people sleeping rough are based on a single night count of people bedding down or about to bed down on the streets or in tents, doorways or encampments. These estimates do not include people in shelters or hostels or who are able to find a friend's sofa on which to spend the night, and as such greatly underestimates the true scale of the problem. But according to former Home Secretary Suella Braverman, this is not a problem at all. It's a lifestyle choice. The UK COVID inquiry has been taking evidence from Conservative Minister Michael Gove, who was a Cabinet Office Minister and Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster when the pandemic began in 2020. In a WhatsApp message Mr Gove sent to Boris Johnson's chief adviser Dominic Cummings in March of that year, Mr Gove complained, in a rare instance of honesty, "We are F with two stars, king up as a government." Well, indeed, the Conservatives were effing up before 2020, and they've continued to do so ever since. Mr Gove added that the UK was certainly not well enough prepared for the unfolding COVID-19 pandemic, and apologised to victims and bereaved families for government failures during that time. He did not demur when it was put to him that the Cabinet Office was in chaos during the early stages of the pandemic. A column written by the wee ginger Doug. The National News on Wednesday, the 29th of November. Rent increases now above inflation across Scotland as landlords hike prices. An article written by Abby Garton-Crosby. Landlords have hiked the price of private rental properties above inflation in the past year, new figures have shown. The monthly cost for 1, 2, 3 and 4 bedroom properties all jumped well above the 9% Consumer Price Index rate of inflation in the past 12 months, prompting outrage from tenants' rights campaigners. In Greater Glasgow, properties for rent saw an increase of £191 in the past year, with 11 out of 18 areas in Scotland seeing above inflation rises. The figures released by the Scottish Government are based on advertised rents, reflecting the prices landlords charge tenants when the properties become available. The current rent cap restrictions, where landlords are limited to a 3% increase in rent each year, only apply to existing tenancies. The latest figures show the average rent for a two-bedroom property, the most common available in the sector, increased by £105 to reach an average of £841 per month. Lothian had the highest average monthly rent for a two-bedroom property at £1,192, while Dumfries and Galloway had the lowest at £487. Overall, average rents across all property size categories rose above the 9% inflation rate. One-bedroom properties increased by £68 per month to £648. The price of a three-bedroom property rose by £121 to £1,026, and four-bedroom properties jumped by £196 a month to £1,656. And a one-bedroomed shared property price increased by £64 to £490 per month. Aditi Jahangir, Living Rent Secretary, said of the figures, "Year after year, whilst the rest of us have been forced to tighten our belts, landlords have raked in huge profits, hiking up rents and forcing tenants out of the places they called home. The rent cap is a huge relief for tenants already in homes in the private rented sector. However, as the hikes in new market rents demonstrate, unless the Scottish Government acts now, thousands of tenants will be faced with astronomical increases when the cap runs out in March. From March, tenants need to be able to properly challenge rent increases until the Scottish Government introduces rent controls to cap rents between tenancies and to bring rents down." The figures are even more stark when analysing the change between 2010 and 2023. Rents in Greater Glasgow for a two-bedroomed property increased by 86.2%, in Lothian by 79.3%, in East Dumbartonshire by 54.5% and in Forth Valley by 51.9%. Both Greater Glasgow and Lothian have seen increases in average rents across all property sizes, while Dundee and Angus, Eastern Bartonshire, Fife and Forth Valley all saw average rent increases above inflation for all properties except one-bedroom properties. Elsewhere, Argyll and Bute, the Ayrshires and Dumfries and Galloway have seen increases in average rates of less than half the rate of inflation between 2010 and 2023 across all property sizes. We told how the rent cap and ban on evictions was extended for a final 6 months in September, giving protections for existing tenancies until March 2024, ahead of the housing bill and expected rent controls. The emergency legislation, the Cost of Living Tenant Protection Act, was introduced in October 2022 and initially froze private rents. It was then amended to allow a 3% increase in a 12-month period, with landlords able to apply for a 6% increase if they could prove that the higher increase was needed. Private sector landlords challenged the rent freeze in court, but a senior judge ruled that it was not unlawful. Landlords had called for a judicial review, arguing they had been discriminated against. John Blackwood, chief executive of the Scottish Association of Landlords, said, "The figures published today highlight the need for the Scottish Government to end damaging rhetoric and encourage investment in all parts of the housing sector in Scotland, so we have more homes in the social sector, more owner-occupied in the private rented sector." Over 20,000 properties have been removed from the private rented sector in recent years, reducing supply and driving up prices. The Scottish Government must work with all partners and groups involved in the Scottish housing sector so we can develop practical, implementable policies that will lead to an end to Scotland's housing crisis. An article written by Abby Garton-Crosby.
From the National, Thursday the 30th of November, from the news section, Glasgow Barra's Market makes huge announcement, by Morgan Carmichael. The famous Barra's Market has made a huge announcement this week. The East End landmark has revealed that it will soon be expanding its market trading spaces due to huge demand. The news means that there will now be a huge outdoor piece of land within the markets. The venue has revealed that it is currently levelling out the area to soon add a covered marquee, allowing people to browse and shop in all weather conditions. The news was announced yesterday on Facebook Barra's Market, and they wrote, "We have big news. Due to phenomenal demand, we are so excited to announce that we have expanded our marketing trading spaces. Introducing the newest addition to our market experience, a huge outdoor piece of land within Barra's Market. We are currently in the process of levelling out the area, and soon we will be adding a covered marquee to provide you with a comfortable and enjoyable shopping environment, snow or shine. It comes as the Barra's also announced some of its market dates and times in the coming weeks, such as late night shopping from 5 p.m. till 10 p.m. on Tuesday, December the 21st. They will also be bringing back their Christmas Eve midnight shopping tradition. Barra's Markets is open every Saturday and Sunday between 10 and 4 p.m. This is an article, Glasgow Barra's Market makes huge announcement, by Morgan Carmichael. The National, Thursday the 30th of November. The news section. More than a third of households in fuel poverty in energy-rich Scotland, by Steph Braun. More than a third of households are in fuel poverty in energy-rich Scotland, shocking new statistics have shown. Figures from National Energy Action show around 850,000, 34%, are in fuel poverty, while more than 500,000, 23%, are in extreme fuel poverty. The findings have led to fresh calls for the Scottish Parliament to be given powers over energy by Westminster. Polling by NEA also found that of the 49% of adults in the UK that had turned their heating off even though it was cold over the last 3 months, Scots were more likely to say they had done so. This is all while Scotland produces 6 times more gas than it consumes and 2/3 of its electricity comes from renewable sources in Scotland. Dave Dugan, the SNP's energy spokesperson, said the statistics were horrifying. He said, "This is the consequence of decades of failed energy policy from Westminster governments we haven't voted for. For too long, the UK Treasury has raked in the profits that Scotland's natural resources have generated, while seeing nothing in return." We saw it again with the recent autumn statement. The Westminster government failed to use the profits to give families in Scotland a £400 energy rebate. If Westminster won't act, it must devolve energy and welfare powers to Scotland so we can. It is clear that only with the full powers of independence can we chart our own course to green growth in a wider European market. Scotland has the energy, we just need the powers. The poll showed of the 41% of UK prepayment customers who were self-disconnected over the last 3 months, Scottish households with prepayment meters were more likely to say they had done this. And of the 43% of the UK adults who had gone to bed to stay warm over the last 3 months, Scots were more likely to say they had done so. The SNP called for action from the UK government last month, as data revealed the three parliamentary constituencies facing the highest average increase in energy bills were in Scotland. Orkney and Shetland, Ross Skye and Lochaber, and Na e Éilean an Ar face the highest average increases in energy bills, with £227, £219 and £206 respectively. The Glasgow Central seat was also 12th on the list, with an increase expected of £154 on average per household. At the other end of the scale, Esher and Walton, Chesham and Amersham and Beaconsfield in the south of England are set to see an average drop in prices of £159, £157 and £150. This was an article, "More than a third of households in fuel poverty in energy-rich Scotland," by Steph Braun.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hume Review and to tell your friends about our service.